Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, July 4th, 2022, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And here in the U.S., July 4th is our Independence Day, so happy Independence Day, and may you not be afraid of fireworks, because if you live anywhere like L.A., you're going to be hearing them all night. I'm very lucky that my dog is not afraid of them, but I'm unlucky in that I have a very big surgery in the morning. Yes, I'm recording this ahead of time, so I'm time traveling a little bit. But I wanted to talk to you guys about a little bit of news today. Before I do that, though, I did want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. I want to thank my top patrons, and I do this in order of the tiers that individuals commit to for the show. So this week, the top tier patrons include Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Mary Neva, and the next tier is Brian Holden, David Compton, Dudas Infinitas, Gabriel F. Jaramillo Gonzalez, Joe Wilkinson, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, and Ulrika Hagman. And there are many, many, many more of you, and I thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart. You make Talk Nerdy possible, and you've really helped me over the past several weeks to be able to do a bunch of episodes and get them banked, because I'm going to be out for probably 3 or 4 weeks after this surgery. Now, I talk about it more in the show. Also, if you're a listener to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, you will have heard me talk about it on the episode that just dropped the Saturday before this episode dropped. So I'm going to leave it at that. I'm not going to do too much here at the top about it, but just know that the next several episodes were recorded in advance so that I can give myself the time to recover and heal. And I just thank you all so much for your good vibes. And it's just, it's tough, it's scary, but I'm just really, really glad to have all of you and all of your support and just this incredible community that that I'm just privileged to be a part of. All right, so I guess that's the business. Let's talk about the show. This show is it's one that's near and dear to my heart. Like I said, I come out with some news during this episode that I didn't even know I was ready to share, but I'm really, really glad I did it. And I really want to thank my interview this week, Rachel, for her compassion and patience and support during this chat. I think it's also important to note that we did record this interview prior to the SCOTUS decision this past week, when Roe v. Wade was officially overturned. Obviously, we knew it was coming because of the leak just under 2 months ago now. But we did record this before, you know, the massive news. So I had the opportunity to sit down with Rachel E. Gross. She's a science journalist, actually an award-winning science journalist. She was the recipient of a 2018-2019 Knight Science Journalism Fellowship, and she was the former digital editor of Smithsonian Magazine, and you've probably read her work. She's written for BBC Future, The New York Times, and Scientific American, and I realize in the show that I've actually cited her work on the SGU. So, small world, love it to death, just such a fascinating chat. And she's here to talk about her new book. It's called Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. So without any further ado, here she is, Rachel Gross. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Cara, thanks for having me.
And thanks for being flexible with our timing. I lost internet this morning because we had a once in a, I don't know, several year thunderstorm here in LA. It was quite beautiful, but it really disrupted my sleep.
Sometimes weather happens and California is the better for it.
It's true, because weather rarely happens in California. So I will take it. It definitely, I grew up in Texas and it definitely felt like Texas. And I am just realizing, this is so funny, I am literally just realizing that I may have cited one of your pieces on another podcast I do, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, when I did a What's the Word segment on the word pudendum.
I wonder if I heard that one, because I definitely heard a podcast about pudendum.
It was just a short, it probably was like a 15-minute part of the overall episode, but I was like, pissed when I read about this. And so, gosh, before we even dive into your book, since that was on SGU, some of my listeners listen to both, but some people here might not have heard it. Can we talk about Pudendum for a minute?
Absolutely. Always here to talk about that.
Thank you. Okay. So first tell us what it is, like where it is in the body, and then the big reveal, what the actual translation is. Like, what does the word physically mean?
Right. So pudendum is a word that appears still in most gynecological and a lot of anatomical textbooks. So med students will come across it, and it's kind of the more formal way to refer to the vulva, which is all the outer female genitalia. And usually you'll see a little bit of etymology in the textbook. So it'll point you to the bottom and then it'll say pudendum, and it'll helpfully define it as the part for which you should be ashamed. And the crazy part is there's not, like, on some of the books I have, there's no comment on that. Like,
oh, it's just like, here, teach this far and wide to, right, to the medical student. So then they can impart this on their patients.
Yeah, like, this is just the definition. Like, we're going to bother to give you the history, but no context. So it's a very old word. It was used by, like, the father of anatomy, Vesalius, in the 1500s. Freud used it. And it only recently, in the past year, kind of came under fire by the International Anatomist Association, which had a long protracted fight over whether they wanted to give up this word, given that a lot of people were offended by it. And it's, you know, not exactly scientifically accurate. Yeah.
I can't even tell you, like, after that happened on the SGU, I usually get mixed. I'm the only woman on the show. It's like four white dudes and me. And so I usually get, a lot of love and a little bit of, like, atrocious hate in the emails and the comment boards and stuff. It's, you know, whatever. It's not a new story. It's a very typical situation for women who do science communication. But after I did that segment, I remember, you know, some people were like, are you kidding me? Like, you know, they reached out and they were like, what the actual? And then I do remember getting one email that was like, the pudendal nerve exists in both men and women, so it can't be sexist. And I was like, oh my God, you are very much missing the point.
Missing the point. Yes, yes. That is exactly what a lot of male anatomists told me. They said, well, maybe we should come up with a male pudendum so it's even and, you know, spread the shame around equally. And I was like, that doesn't seem to be the cause of the anger here. And, like, yeah, it's unfortunate that pudendal nerve is so entrenched that no one's going to change it and that it does apply to both bodies, but that doesn't.
But literally, can we just call it the genital nerve or something?
Oh my,
like,
gosh.
It's not that hard.
Yes. And they were reluctant to give up pudendum for vulva when there's a perfectly good word, the vulva, right there. Right. Like, there's no reason not to use it. It's not any less accurate. I think maybe what some people took issue with was originally, like, way back when, pudendum did refer to the genitals of males and females and, like, animals and people. But basically by the modern medical era, it was only used for female genitals. And it's not just this one word that you might never hear in your lifetime. Like, I kept seeing this pattern as I was researching where in German, the term for the labia is Schamlippen or shame lips.
Oh, somebody emailed me that too. They, like, a German listener was like, oh, if you like that, get
this. Right. I can recommend you. Yeah. So there's several terms like that in different languages. And there also was a history of men naming parts of the female genitals with the word shame embedded. Like, a French anatomist dissected the human clitoris at one point and he named it, like, the member of shame, or again, the shame part. So it's not just one word.
And even in these situations where there's a clear kind of value judgment that was baked into the biomedical literature, even beyond that, you see this kind of fundamental, and this persists to this day, but this fundamental view, like, the male body is the normative and the female body is the other. You see it in how we diagnose heart attacks that female have, quote, atypical symptoms for heart attack, even though they're totally typical. They're just typical for women, not for men. One of the examples I often like to use is in my old gym. I remember I was working out once with my trainer and I looked up and there were two charts on the wall. And one said the musculoskeletal system, and it had like, you know, a schematic of a man. And the other one said the female musculoskeletal system. Oh my God. And I was like, really? Really?
Doctors and lady doctors. Scientists and yeah. lady scientists.
Oh, it was so infuriating.
That's a great example, though.
Take this to a very, very extreme place. And this was another kind of conversation we had on the SGU on a live show several months back. And it sort of just came up naturally. Like, it wasn't pre-planned. It wasn't something I had ever really deeply thought about before. But we were talking about how it's so baked in, these gender, this normativity of maleness is so baked in that when you see bathroom logos, when you see cartoon characters, the man is the default and the woman has the eyelashes or she's wearing the skirt. And that has always blown my mind because when I was talking to the guys, they were like, yeah, but how else would you define it? And I was like, maybe the woman is generic and the man has a mustache?
Mm.
Like, why does it have to be the other way around? Why does the guy have to be the default body? And then the woman has to have a skirt to be shown that she's woman?
Incredible question. And I mean, it just goes back so many centuries. I remember looking at, again, like anatomy textbooks, but from the 1500s. And there was like clearly a hairy penis, but the hair was at like the glands of the penis. And then it was labeled uterus. And the idea was that women have male genitals turned inside out. So the ovaries did not have the name of their own until the 1600s. They were just called female testicles. And the uterus was often thought of as an inside out penis. And the female was sort of this like unfinished, imperfect, interior version of the male. And I think Galen actually referred to female genitals as like the eyes of a mole. So like not fully developed.
Wow. What? Okay. So clearly in researching and writing your book and just a lot of the journalism that you do, even probably prior to the book or leading up to the book, clearly you read a lot of things that would make my blood boil. So I'm curious about your process in saying, okay, I want to write this book. This is going to be something that I focus on. How am I going to choose, you know, what to include, what not to include? But even before we get to that, like, what is it that made you say, Vagina Obscura, that's going to be what I write about?
I always wrote about like reproductive biology and animal sex. I have covered science for maybe 10 years as a reporter and editor. So I knew that there was something about this topic that was really sticky for me, no puns intended. But I just think it gets at so many taboos and attitudes and like pokes some people in the nerve, maybe the pudendal nerve. And it was just very interesting to me to like bring out all these emotions within science, which a lot of people still think is supposed to be objective and neutral. So I was an editor at Smithsonian Magazine in, I think it was like 2016, 17. And I helped launch this column, Unsung Women in the History of Science. And it was, you know, basically these in-depth profiles of women who really revolutionized their fields and all the systemic challenges that they faced to do so. And it was just becoming very clear to me that we had all of these basic questions in reproductive science and questions about the female body that weren't answered. And here was just this obvious explanation. There have been all of these systemic ways of keeping women and LGBT scientists out of science. And so the people doing all the questioning have been, by and large, white upper class males. So I was interested in looking at this tension and like how our view of the, you know, quote unquote female body is changing now that we are getting a completely new generation of scientists. We actually are learning so many exciting things about female biology and how incredibly dynamic and resilient the uterus and the ovaries are. And it seemed like there's this kind of crest happening that I wanted to capture.
I love that. And so as you were sort of getting inspired to tell these stories, did you develop, as a writer, did you develop the sort of core message, the main takeaway, what you wanted people to get from this in advance? Or did you sort of let it play out as you were writing?
I actually think that the core message that developed, which I think ended up being like totally surprising to me, it's basically the organs that we call the reproductive system or the reproductive organs are actually far, far more than reproductive. They're contributing to our overall health throughout our lifetime, whether or not we are pregnant or intend to get pregnant. Even if we're pregnant for a year or two out of our life, the whole rest of the time, the ovaries are pumping out hormones that are maintaining the health of your blood and bones and brain. The uterus is regenerating every month and learning how to do its job better and interacting with the immune system. Your vaginal microbiome is also kind of an extension of your immune system, kind of creating this permeable barrier between you and not you, and helping protect you from invading microbes. So I realized there was just so much more going on. There were so many dynamic mechanisms and organs doing their thing, and that even the very basic terms we call them kind of leads us in the wrong direction. But again, this only came out after I had finished writing the book, essentially. So the first step was really thinking of a structure, like a container for it. And the first thing that hit me was kind of a journey to the center of the earth, but journey to the center of the female body. So going organ by organ, the clitoris gets two chapters because it deserves it. Nice. But then we also have like the vagina, the vaginal microbiome, the ovaries, the uterus. And each chapter I would try to pinpoint like a kind of trailblazing scientist, usually a woman who was historic or modern, but was reconceptualizing this organ, just reimagining what it's for, what it does, and would follow them and how our idea of that organ changed over time. And as I kept doing this with each organ, I would just reach this similar conclusion and similar themes. And that was, oh, we kind of thought that the ovaries just sat around like as this egg basket. Turns out, they're actually, again, supporting almost every tissue in the body. And we don't necessarily just run out of eggs and hit menopause. It's a lot more complicated than that. There are a lot many forces at play, more forces at play than we thought. And there's a ton of communication happening within this like dense, like very dynamic ball of cells.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think about sometimes when it comes to just information absorption, information gathering, I read a lot. And when I'm reading, I often think about who wrote the book, where they were coming from, and then who the sort of intended audience is, or maybe who you would never think would pick this up and how they might be affected. And for your book especially, like clearly cis women who want to learn more about their bodies, learn more about the history, learn more about, you know, some of the kind of misunderstandings, missteps, miscalculations. This is a very empowering read. Clearly, trans women who are, you know, curious about these organs and want to learn more, this is a very empowering read. Trans men who are, whether they've, you know, wherever they are in their journey, who want to understand what's going on with their bodies, very important read. And I think for cis men, let me tell you, there are just so many people out there. Okay, I have to tell you a little story. Just going to set the scene here. A little bit personal, but I think it's going to be important. Okay, so several years ago, I don't know, I'm not going to say how many because I don't want to call this person out by name, but I was dating a man who is a very, very smart man, a man with advanced degrees in not a biomedical field. So how do I do this without saying who this is? A person, let's just say, Yes, this person was a rocket scientist. Let's say that. Okay. Very, very smart. And I had to have a colposcopy during the time that we were dating. And a colposcopy, for those who don't know, is an exam when you have an abnormal pap where they look at your cervix. And very often they biopsy your cervix without anesthesia. So this was my first time. Since then, I've had many, many colposcopies. But this was my first time to have a colposcopy. And all the tools were laid out on the tray. So there's this big, horrifying looking punch biopsy machine, and there's like, you know, the stuff that stops you from bleeding and the gloves and all the little jars that they put the tissue samples in. And I take a picture of it, you know, while I'm gowning up, and I text the person at the time who's my boyfriend, and I say, "I'm scared." And his response is, "Pocket the lube."
What? What?
Yeah. Hilarious, right? So I'm like,
wow, how empathetic.
I know. And this is a person who's clearly, who's older than me, who's very intelligent. And I'm like, okay.
That's not about intelligence. That's about like,
right.
Do I
humanity
care about this person being in a place of fear?
Right. So I'm struggling with this throughout the situation. It's horrible. It's whatever. I see him that night and I'm telling him that what he said made me feel terrible. And he's like, "Well, I guess I didn't really understand, like, what were you there for?" And I was like, "A cervical biopsy." And he was looking at me with these hollow eyes. And finally, I go, "Do you know where the cervix is?" And he was like, "No."
Oh, my God. At least he said that instead of like, "Oh, yeah, of course."
Yeah. And so not that this excuses his lack of humanity, because that was a garbage situation. That was just color that I added to the story. But this was a person with a PhD in literally rocket science who did not know where the cervix is. What hope do we have?
Absolutely. No, like this, this doesn't surprise me. I mean, like the lack of humanity does surprise and offend me.
Right, right.
But just the not knowing where the cervix is or not knowing what a cervical biopsy is, that does not surprise me. And honestly, I think quite a lot of cis women wouldn't know what that was or is. And in some ways, it's not your fault. I think that medicine and our version of sex ed in this country really mystifies and pulls a veil over our anatomy. Just think about your average pap smear gynecological exam where you have a sheet put over half your body so that the doctor's like working under the hood and seeing things that you can't. So your body is made a mystery to you.
You're like, so right. That's every gynecologist I had until my current one worked that way. My current one is amazing. She's like, "You want me to take a picture with your cell phone?"
Like, <she's, laughs> selfie.
There's like none of that. Cause I'm always like, "What does it look like in there?" And she's like, "I can take a picture. I can hold it up to the thing," which is so cool. But yeah, prior to her, I've never had a gynecologist. Like it was always very hush hush. I'm in, "Oh, don't worry. I'm just going to feel around now." But she like talks me through everything. And I think but you're right. She's probably
sounds awesome. I want her
an outlier.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. But I think there is definitely a movement to kind of democratize people's bodies to themselves. And it's not like we haven't done this before. We had like the women's self-help movement of the second wave feminist movement in the 1970s. And you had women in groups using speculums and really like creating images and knowledge about their bodies that no doctors had, and that were kind of stripping away these biases and this shame that made everything hidden, you know, back to the shame parts. But for some reason, that has not infiltrated medicine until maybe recently.
It sounds like until really the gender dynamic of medicine started to shift. Because, you know, if I were my mother's age, I probably wouldn't have a female OB or female gynecologist. Like, just most options were men. But I've been lucky that probably my past three gynecologists were women, and all of my physicians, and I've been dealing with some like pretty major health stuff lately. For anybody who's been following me on Instagram, you've probably seen some posts, but like, my hematologist is a woman. My cardiologist is a woman. My primary care physician is a woman. My gynecologist is a woman. And I can imagine that that shift in parity has opened up this field in a way that it was like really never exposed to previously.
Right. I think that is a shift I'm really interested in exploring in the book, because I'm talking to a lot of kind of the first like maybe not the first women in their fields, but the first ones that have reached a certain level. Like, for instance, the first female urologist, not neurologist, but urologist, as in urinary, in Australia, was also the woman credited with fully mapping the clitoris using modern tools. And she was really, like, realized that this needed to happen because it was very clear to her that in her textbooks, the penis would get 10 pages of description, and then the clitoris would be omitted from some diagrams, and in others, it would be described as kind of this failure of formation of the penis or this minuscule structure, and there would be no guidelines about where the nerves were and what to avoid when doing a urethra surgery on a woman, which she would end up doing in her field. So she knew there was this huge lack, and she also had access to the women's health movement and those materials, which really showed the structure of the clitoris quite differently. And so she took it on to see what was really going on and use MRI imaging and microdissection and basically realized that this outdated notion of the clitoris needed a rewrite and a rethink. And so, you know, it is obvious that her gender and her position as the only woman in this field had a lot to do with that. But on the other hand, it does not mean that just having more women in one field will make things better, because scientists are still trained in the same paradigm. It's the same structures around them. There are plenty of bad female OBGYNs and female doctors. And there are just so many other types of marginalized perspectives that also need to come into play. So obviously we need more doctors of color and scientists of color, but kind of unexpected things, like there was a scientist, an ovarian scientist, who was the first in his generation, or the first generation in his family to go to college. And he also started working on chicken ovaries, which is really rare for ovarian biologists. They usually stick to one thing, which is humans. And he kind of learned in his graduate school training that chicken ovaries are super regenerative. You can cut out essentially the entire ovary and it will grow back. Sometimes it'll even grow into a testy. Also, chicken ovaries are really crazy. They're like these handfuls of like cherry tomatoes, and each one is an egg in a different stage of growth. As you can imagine, that get pretty big. Anyways, so he comes to human ovaries and he finds this kind of dogma of the field, which is that women are born with all the eggs they'll ever have. They lose them throughout their lifetime. Eventually, they run out around 45 to 55, and then they hit menopause. And
that's what people still believe that.
Oh, very much. That's still the dominant paradigm. And even though for 20 years, he's been kind of critiquing that and showing that that doesn't match with the data and like playing the math out and even experimenting on many species, including like mice and zebrafish. So it looks like women too can probably make eggs throughout their lifetime. We don't know if they actually are, because most of the studies are not in vivo, but it's just like this very obvious thing that someone who studied a different species and thought about ovaries as regenerative and not as simply degenerating organs that fizzle out and die would notice. So there are different types of backgrounds that are important to bring into science as well.
Absolutely. Just different, like, you know, diverse perspectives can come from everywhere, from what you study, from where you grew up, from, you know, the experiences that you had throughout your life. And of course, I think the point that you made at the beginning of kind of this last comment is one that's really important to reiterate and highlight, which is that women themselves can perpetuate misogyny because it's internalized in our culture. We ourselves struggle with our own implicit misogyny. And so just because more women are at the table doesn't necessarily mean that just, okay, we're done now. You know, all the wrongs are righted.
Exactly. I think that's kind of a dangerously simplistic takeaway from all of this. The other thing is that in order to get power and rise up in fields that are traditionally pretty masculinist, you of course have to kind of conform to the rules, and you have to sometimes adapt yourself to like the masculine structure. So I talked to a lot of really high level women scientists who kind of didn't consider themselves feminist or like looked down on that kind of women's empowerment stuff because they felt they had really fought to get where they were and they were about doing things, not like, quote, complaining. And I think that's, you know, a misunderstanding of what feminism and this whole concept of breaking down assumptions in a field is about. But
yeah, I recently interviewed an older woman who was very much a trailblazer in her field, and I was very saddened by a lot of responses to her questions, sort of like, oh, we're everything's better now, we're past it. Like,
she said that,
you know. Yeah.
Yeah, right. There's that tendency to really think that we have moved towards progress and we always will move towards progress. And I mean, people love to cite the fact that in 1992, the NIH finally said, yeah, you have to include women and minorities and women who are minorities in your clinical trials. And they're like, first, that's shocking that it took that long. Again, they were considering the male to be like the normative. But second, like, oh, we address that now. So we used to have this problem, but now we look at men and women equally. And
right. That's so bananas. And like, there's so many reasons that we can, but first of all, like all of the literature before that is still like super not valid. And even with newer studies, there's so many things we could say. Like, so I didn't realize this until 4 or 5 years ago. I had somebody on my show. I want to say it was Sarah Hill, but I apologize if it wasn't you, Sarah, because I've had a lot of women who have written really great books about these kinds of issues. And someone I had on the show, I think Sarah Hill, talking about birth control, someone was saying, did you know that when you're taking hormones, basically, in the form of birth control, it affects your cortisol response? So almost every study that's been done on stress and hormones, they just straight up don't include women who are on birth control in their study pool, which is like so many women.
Also kind of ironic because one of the original disqualifiers was that if women were having their periods, that would mess up their hormones. So like if you're not having your period, you're most likely on birth control, but then you're also disqualified. So it's a rigged game. And you can't have pregnant women, obviously. So just no way.
Oh, of course, because they're just completely not normal. I mean, it's just, oh yeah, I have a friend who's very pregnant right now, and we were talking about her work stuff and how she wants to, you know, how does she want to handle maternity leave? And they were trying to figure out with her, because she works for a very small company, like how they're going to go about it and what model they're going to use, because I think this is the first time they've, you know, had to approach this in their company. Yeah. And she was like, one of the people that she was talking to was like, oh, well, when my wife was pregnant, she took out disability.
Oh my God.
I was like, wait, what? Yeah, and it was like, well, yeah. Like, and I was like, that's not a disability.
Wow.
But that's typical.
Back to what you said. Like, it's just the whole structure is around like a man who doesn't get pregnant as the norm, and anything else is atypical to the point of being a disability. Crazy.
Yeah, it's like we treat it like it's a medical condition. We insure it like it's a medical condition. It's not a medical condition. Like, yes, you need additional support during your pregnancy, just like you need additional support during almost any life stage, but it's not, there's nothing wrong with you for being,
it makes me think of the term like fall pregnant as if it's like fall ill, like, oh, yes, she's fallen into a ditch and she can't get up. She's pregnant.
Like, oh my God.
She's found herself with child. Put her in the laying down hospital.
Yeah. She needs to rest. She's suffering from exhaustion.
Yes, put her in the room with the yellow wallpaper.
Good. Yeah, on the fainting couch. It's just bananas. Did you see the documentary that recently came out about the abortion group Jane, the Jane Collective?
I haven't yet. No, I would like to.
Good. I highly recommend it. I didn't know much about their story, but basically, in the years right before abortion was became legal, and of course now this is very apropos because we're worried that we're going to go back to this place. These women were like offering abortions covertly. And at first they would get physicians who were willing to do the abortions and they would, you know, pay them and they would, you know, have this whole network together to help these women. And eventually they just learned how to do it themselves. And it was pretty incredible. I mean, it speaks to what you were saying about this kind of group of women who said, you know, I want to understand this more. This doesn't need to be like, we don't need a man to do this. This is our own body and this is our own capability. And it's empowering to know thyself.
It's empowering and you don't need a man, but also the particular professionalized men doing it are actively blocking you from understanding your body and being empowered to the point of having the medical interventions you want. And you are dependent on a system that may decide that birth control or abortion is immoral and withhold it from you. So it's pretty radical. And I think that often we think of like the Jane Collective as super radical and which was necessary to meet their times. And we think of those self-help women with the speculums as kind of this like fringe thing. But actually, I think all of these movements were really integral to changing medicine and introducing these concepts of like collaborative medicine and empowered, intelligent patients and having them be like partners in their own health. And I think that we sort of obscure that history by making it seem very fringe and, you know, it had to be underground for various reasons, but I think we owe that a lot.
I agree, you know, and I've been struggling. It's interesting. I'm probably going to trip on my words here. And so please, Rachel, bear with me, but I feel like your book came out a couple of months ago, and it's weirdly apropos that we are meeting right now. So I'm recording this on June 22nd, but it's going to air. I want to say, let me just open up my air date calendar. it's going to air on July 4th. And part of the reason that I am banking a few episodes right now is because I have a major surgery scheduled for July 5th. And I've been really struggling. I'm going to be out from my other show, the SGU, for like 3 weeks, maybe four. And the guys were asking me, you know, what do you want us to say on air when you're not here? And it was kind of like do I want to say what I'm dealing with? Do I not? How personal do I want to be? How much is this about like, it's nobody's fucking business but my own? And how much of this is about like, well, other people might be dealing something similar and I have a platform. And I don't know, just talking to you today, I think it's really inspired me that I want to talk about this because I think it speaks to exactly what your book is all about. But I sadly was diagnosed with something called adenocarcinoma in situ. So it's a type of cancer, but it's not really cancer because they call it pre-cancer, cancer stage zero sometimes. So in situ is the operative term there. Sometimes you'll hear it pronounced in situ. And that's a type of endocervical neoplasia that has not yet invaded the basement membrane. So it's caught very early, luckily. And I was just lucky enough that I had abnormal glandular tissue on a pap, had a follow-up, skipped the colposcopy this time and went straight to a LEAP and a DNC. So that was the time when I was under anesthesia for the first time in my life about 5 weeks ago. Super scary, but I got through it. And so sadly, this diagnosis, the only recourse is a hysterectomy. And yeah, and that's what is on the books for me on July 5th. And I've come to terms with it. I will tell you, the first weekend that I found out, I just like cried nonstop all weekend. Luckily, I'm 38 years old. I have no interest in children. You can delay this to be fertility sparing, but it's quite brutal because you have to get biopsies every 6 months and you still have to have the surgery. So women who have this diagnosis and also want to have children, my heart goes out to you because that's going to be a brutal process. And clearly, you know what you want. And I really, really respect that. I've had never had an interest in children. So it was no question for me that I wanted to move forward with the surgery as soon as possible. But A, I'm scared shitless. B, this is horrible and it shouldn't be happening, but it is what it is. C, it happened the same weekend that we got the leak. We found out about the Roe v. Wade leak.
Oh, God. To be thinking about your rights over your reproductive choices and your like reproductive organs at a time like this when we're in such fear and anxiety over that, and where it's so clear that these need to be your decisions and you need to have like ultimate control over every step of this experience. It must be so weird to be just relating it to, obviously, abortion and...
Yeah, for sure. And in some ways, it's funny because I had just had a DNC for diagnostic purposes. But of course, a DNC for women in early term abortion, that is the abortion procedure. It's where they inflate your uterus and they kind of do a scraping along the inside of your uterus. For me, it was to look at the tissue and see if there was any cancer in it. But for some women, it's to actually remove any adhered, egg or embryo.
But this and absolutely,
so yeah, there's a lot of parallels there, right, which is pretty interesting.
And it speaks to the fact that like the tools and procedures and knowledge used in abortion care is so much broader than that and is used to like protect all bodies. And that it's just crazy to siphon off this particular like pocket of healthcare. It just makes me think of like that phrase that abortion is healthcare and it's part of this larger system. And you're like experiencing that firsthand.
I totally agree. And I think the thing that's really been, the thing that really hit me while you and I were talking and while looking at your book that made me say, you know, I want to have this conversation is this central theme that somehow being a woman is tied to our reproductive capability, being a woman is tied to our organs. Because I personally, and I mean, people who know me know that I'm like a pretty liberal, pretty progressive, very feministic, strong, what's the word? Like kind of strong-willed, and I have strong opinions. Yet, even when I got this news, I was like, am I going to be less of a woman? I don't want kids, but I'm going to lose this fundamental. So I'm lucky. I have to have a total hysterectomy, not a radical hysterectomy. So I keep my ovaries. Yeah. So I don't have to do any hormone replacement. It's very important, right? I'm not going to have to really struggle. And for many women who lose their ovaries, there's a lot of kind of medical intervention they have to have because of, as you mentioned, yeah, the ovaries do a lot more than just, make eggs. But I still have a total hysterectomy, meaning they remove the uterus, the fallopian tubes, and the cervix. So they have to sew up something called a vaginal cuff at the very, very end of the vagina in order to reclose that portion and to strengthen it, because it's pretty much now the only thing between your internal organs, literally your intestines, and the outside world, which is bananas to think about. Obviously you can't get pregnant anymore. You don't have the capacity for that, which is kind of cool. I'm down. Yeah. there's a lot of tissue that's removed that we have historically really fundamentally identified. Like you talk about individuals who are super anti-trans rights, and they are like, there's a biological sex, and if you have a penis, you're a man, and if you have a vagina, you're a woman, or if you have a uterus, you're a woman. And it's like, well, what, am I not going to be a woman now?
Right. I mean, first of all, I'm really, really touched that you're sharing this experience that you're going through right now that is so like raw and in the moment. Like that takes a lot when you are still processing. Second of all, what you're describing is totally an instinct that I heard from so many people in this book. I talked to a lot of women who'd undergone genital cutting, and they were looking at this surgery that it kind of relies on the true anatomy of the clitoris, realizing that there's all this buried erectile tissue and that it's really like an underground like city rather than a little nub. And it tries to lift up some of that tissue to expose it. And it's questionable whether it like works. But the thing I kept hearing from all these women was like, I want to feel whole again. I want to feel more like a woman. I want to have back this part of me that I lost. So there was clearly this deep connection, with like that part of the body. And I did hear it from women who had endometriosis and were considering, or had had a hysterectomy, and definitely from intersex people that I was talking to that had these non-consensual surgeries that removed like their gonads or their genitals, like their ovaries, their testes, their clitoris. And
right. Cause that used to happen all the time when there was ambiguous, like a baby was born intersex and the physicians were like, we want to have a clean gender on the birth certificate. The easiest low-hanging fruit was to, quote, feminize the baby, right? And that so many people were subject to that without their consent, even sometimes without the parents' consent.
Yeah, there's a really long history of doing this throughout the 20th century. And I think the fight to stop medically unnecessary genital surgeries is still definitely ongoing. There's only a few hospitals that have really banned it in this country. And like only now is there this growing awareness that this is this violation of bodily autonomy and consent and your right to your sexuality. So yeah, in all these ways, like the loss of these body parts is felt as a loss to identity, and some like deep wound. And, you know, some of that depends on like, do you feel like you truly had a choice and that this was taken from you? And part of that is this historic like tying up of female identity in the genitals. Like in medical textbooks, like I've been talking about, you often, as you were saying with the gym, you'll see like the whole human being, and that's like the human anatomy. And then on the next page, you'll see like the breasts and the uterus, and it'll be like, and that's female anatomy. So like trot her out when we're talking about reproduction. Mm-hmm. But also like wrapped up in these body parts and the ability to give birth. And I was also just thinking, like, with hysterectomy, it sounds like in your case, it makes complete sense. But there is often an assumption in medicine that when a woman is past an age where she wants to or can give birth, then the uterus is like this optional organ that she doesn't really need, and that the first line defense.
And it's just easier to get rid of it. Yeah. I hear this a lot. Yeah. And you see it. I mean, luckily for women who have endometriosis, very often it's like a godsend for them. But there's a lot of choice in that. I think with AIS specifically, it's a very strange thing because, I mean, not to bore anybody, but the risk of skip lesions is very high. So in my case, my leap came back positive for AIS with negative margins. My endocervical curettage was negative and my DNC was negative. So there's a very good chance we got all of the precancer, but the risk of skip lesions is so, so high. And a skip lesion is where it's like non-continuous neoplasia. So you might think you got it, but then deeper somewhere else in the organ, a new neoplasia crops up. And adenocarcinoma beyond in situ, so stage one, stage two, stage, it's a very, very bad cancer. And so the evidence just shows better to remove any reservoir for the cancer than to risk it and check later. But that, you're right, that is a very specific situation. For some women, a hysterectomy is sort of like, I don't know, you could liken it unto those gender surgeries. It's like, well, easiest thing is just to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant, is that there's this fundamental lack of appreciation that this is an important organ that's doing more than just sitting there waiting to make a baby. It is like a radical surgery, and like your organs move around and you have to sew things up. And I just think that's a good example of that fundamental bias about female bodies that's baked into medicine and the kind of decisions that come out of it.
Oh, for sure. And I you know, most of my friends and family who know this have been like obviously very, very supportive, but you definitely do see some kind of pushback of like, well, I know somebody who had a hysterectomy and they were fine, or like, you know, they were back at work in a week or two. And it's like, yeah, just because they could doesn't mean they should. And this is actually a really major surgery, but because it's the most common gynecologic surgery among women, I think people downplay how incredibly brutal it is to go through something like this, not just emotionally, but also physically.
Exactly.
Like, it's a punishing surgery.
Like a C-section.
My gynecologist is like, yeah, like a C-section. Like, yes, it's necessary sometimes, but you don't just bounce back. My gynecologist is like, Kara, you're not doing anything for 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Like nothing.
Right. It's like almost considered like a rite of passage. And I think I was looking at female cadavers at the University of Melbourne. And I remember being told it was very hard to find a female cadaver with a uterus, because I think only a third of the women there still had their uteruses by the time they passed away, which was maybe their 60s, 70s, or 80s. So,
right, because most cadavers are older individuals for sure.
But it definitely speaks to just like how common and like ubiquitous this surgery is to the fact that it is normalized, like you were saying.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely interesting to, I don't know, I think for me, the biggest part that I've struggled with is less about, at the beginning, I did have that, like, will I be less of a woman? And of course, this was due to this very internalized thing. And of course, that's definitely true. I will not be, I will be myself completely. But I think even more than that, it's kind of like, and it was interesting because my own father, who is like, I don't know, we have a whole history. He's very Mormon. I've talked about him on the show and, you know, we have our struggles, but he seemed to have this like empathy for this situation that I did not expect. But he was like, I know you don't want kids, but I can imagine that part of the suffering that you're dealing with right now is having that choice taken away. Like you want to choose no. And that's a big part of it. It's like, I don't want to be told no. I want to say I have the option and I choose no.
Exactly. That's what I was getting at with like the kind of parallels that were coming to mind when you were talking about this.
And of course, this is something that, you know, when we talk about abortion rights, which we can't talk about healthcare and or we can't talk about the vagina and the female reproductive system, or should we even not call it that?
We honestly shouldn't. Like, both female and reproductive are fraught. What I kind of realized writing this book was you were kind of talking about different people that could relate or identify in reading the book. And I realized... And who's the audience? And I realized like we're looking at a history of the female body as a lens to look at all bodies. And that it's not like we only want to know this and read this to understand women better. It's, wow, for most of human history, we have left out half of human bodies and any other bodies we've considered atypical or one or two steps away from the white male. And that has diluted our understanding of all bodies. So this is not just like a part of women's history and female knowledge to write back in. This is like we need to expand all of anatomy and expand knowledge for everyone because we've had such a huge chunk missing. It's like, you know, listening to one side of a phone conversation. Like we've had such a distorted view.
And to be clear, every human being who ever walked the planet or never even got to walk the planet, any human being who was ever remotely formed came through this system.
Yes, like, yeah, and in one way know? Or another. Of course, and interacted with the system. I mean, fortunately, I think there's a good, like, little fan club of cis men on the internet that are like, cis men need to read this book. So I'm like, yeah, guys, you do it. But anyways, to your...
And I can tell you right now that 80%, this is bananas, and it's been something I struggled with from the very beginning of Talk Nerdy. I don't know why, because this year alone, I think like 90% of my interviews have been trans and cis women. But for whatever reason, this is a science show with a female host, and we talk about these issues all the time, and it's very social justice oriented. Like 80% of my listenership is men.
Wow.
And I think that was an old bias from when I first started. Mm. And it was like, ooh, science, science podcast, man, that's listen.
That's yeah, cool. It's like your bananas. Podcast is a Trojan horse. Or
it kind of is like, you know, I didn't.
No matter what
I used
gender.
To be frustrated by it. And I was like, where are the women? But now I'm like, ooh, sneak it to the men. So yes, guys who are listening right now, pick up this book. If you're like, where's the cervix?
Or where's the clitoris?
Yes, you know, exactly.
Hopefully not, but I promise you'll learn news you can use.
I love that.
But yeah.
Oh, I love that so much.
But to your point, like, so, I think female reproductive system is definitely problematic. I'm not sure we have anything much better right now. I like to say the vagina et al. Or the vagina and friends when I'm talking about these.
Like, I love that.
Like some people would go so neutral as to say like pelvic organs, but that's a little much. You could say reproductive and sexual system, but that works more for like a scientific paper, I think.
Right. Yeah. I definitely think that there are always going to be differences between the wonky lexicon that experts use, which still we need to make sure that it's not riddled with, you know, like sexist tropes, like pudendum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which it is. So we still need to be concerned about that.
Yes.
But there's always going to be a difference in how we speak colloquially about things versus how we speak about them in published papers. And that's okay, so long as we're as concerned about our colloquial language as we are about our scientific language.
Right.
Just in terms of it being fair and equitable and,
there's just this,
and not gross.
There's this weird like slipperiness around the like female genitals where you go a lot more vague when you try to talk about them, and like simple accuracy and frankness is considered like too in your face and too like offensive.
Yeah, that's so weird.
So it's like, oh, your nether regions, oh, down there, oh, between your legs. And that I think does bleed into the medical language where people often, you know, don't know the term vulva. And they use vagina for the whole thing. I think that's been called out a lot lately. Or just very like vague terms. I mean, like reproductive system, when really you should be pinpointing the organs and what you're talking about. And it is crazy that so many women don't have the language to talk about their own bodies with accuracy and feeling empowered. Like, that's a huge problem.
Well, I think that's why it's so important that you just straight up called your book Vagina Obscura, like big bold letters. Like, you want that book, you're going to go up to the guy at the bookstore and you're going to go, "Do you carry Vagina Obscura?" And like, I'm not going to, you know, turn red when I say that, because it's nothing to be ashamed about. I mean, you see these stories all the time of like little kids saying the word vagina, then getting in trouble at school because it's like not appropriate language. And you're like, what?
Right, right. And yeah, I agree. That was definitely a choice. And now I'm seeing that play out in reality, where I've had media outlets and institutions be like, "Well, we'd love to cover your book, but it's a little too colorful for us." Or, "Well, we're a family paper." Or, "I think that..."
And families don't have vagina.
Families are vagina free. Or like, "Oh, the male editor of this publication, like, you know, I love the idea, but like, they wouldn't green light it." And that's totally wild to me. And that, I don't know if that would have been different if I'd titled it something else, but I think that the point needed to be clear, which was exactly what you're saying, that we need to call it what it is, that needs to be okay. And I hope for a day when many more books can be frank about what they're about.
Oh, hell yeah. I am definitely on team Be Frank. And this is something that I've talked about it before on my show, and I don't want to like go off on a huge tangent, but I work in now I've kind of switched gears. I still do science communication, but I went back to school for my PhD. So I'm finishing that now. And I work in clinical psychology, and I see patients with in gerontology and psycho-oncology, so cancer, as well as end of life and life-limiting illnesses. And one of the things that I learned very early on, when you're talking about end of life, when you're talking about hospice, when you're talking about these big issues that are very existential, that scare the shit out of people, is that you have to be frank in your language. You don't sugarcoat, you don't use euphemisms, because it's just too fraught and there's too much space for misunderstanding. And I think that that also is the case when we're talking about our own bodies. The more that we sort of use euphemisms, the farther away from truth we get, and the more confusion exists.
And the more distance and disempowered you are from your own reality. That's a fascinating parallel. I never, ever thought of that, but I do think quite a lot about the effect it has on people dealing with endometriosis or reproductive cancer or like sexual issues, that they can't come out and say it. Like, what effect does that have on you and your relationship to your body, that you are ashamed to say what you're going through on a daily basis and why you're in pain? I mean, or even like as common as menstrual pain, like that just tells you that your body and its issues are not appropriate conversation for the rest of the world, and that you need to stay silent and respect the stigma, essentially.
Yeah. And you hear stories all the time of women who are like, "Oh, you know, somebody says, oh, my period was really heavy this week and it was horrible. And they go, oh, really? Like, ugh, I hate it when I bleed for 9 days straight. And they're like, wait, you bleed for 9 days straight? And they're like, yeah. And they're like, I think you should tell your gynecologist that. And they're like, really? That's not normal. And it's like, this is the first time in my life that I've ever realized that that might be something that is treatable or something that's problematic, because literally nobody ever talked about it before. You hear this all the time, like women who have been suffering in silence for years.
Because this specific type of pain is very normalized. Like, to be a woman is to be in pain around your menstrual cycle and your reproductive organs. Like, and that's completely wrong. And this assumption of normalized pain plus the stigma about talking about these body parts, frankly, definitely means that you feel like you're the only one and you need to suck it up. And I think that's another really important consequence of talking frankly, is you get so much connection and understanding and realizing you're not alone, and that brings with it power.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I wanted to open up on this episode right now. I think in terms of the timing, it makes perfect sense. This is why the next several episodes that are going to air, I've pre-recorded like well in advance. And, you know, I feel that. I've talked to a few women who have gone through hysterectomy at a younger age, but all of the ones I've spoken to did it for endometriosis reasons, and their struggle sounded horrible. And I really empathize with them, because I think that they dealt with a lot more, you know, different, but a lot more than I'm dealing with now. But at the same time, for them, the hysterectomy was relief. They were looking, every single person I talked to was looking forward to the surgery because it brought them immense relief. And so my situation is slightly different, because I don't want to have to do this. I'm not in pain right now. I wouldn't have even known I had pre-cancer if we hadn't caught it. I mean, I'm very lucky that we caught it, but I don't want to do this. And so there is still a little bit of that, like, feeling very alone and alien, being so young and not knowing anybody else who's gone through it. But I have to assume that with the reach that the show has, somebody listening right now either went through it or is about to go through it.
Oh, absolutely. And I know that there are really strong online communities for people that have had hysterectomy, and just the experience of going into an accelerated menopause that is very different. Like, there is a community around that, but I think it is more underground and not something that you hear every day until you bring up your own experience. And yeah, I mean,
yeah. And it's hard. It's hard to go like, well, this is only my business, nobody else's, which is true. But also this idea that, like, I realized that part of the reason I hadn't said anything publicly, or part of the reason that I was struggling with whether I should, has to have been shame. Like, I was like, it's not just, oh, it's nobody else's business, but also like, what are they going to think of me? Are they going to think less of me? And I'm very lucky in that I don't have to go through accelerated menopause. Again, like, I get to keep, I'm not having a radical hysterectomy, which is the term for when your ovaries are removed as well. I'm just having a total hysterectomy, meaning they're also taking the cervix and the fallopian tubes. Oh, so confusing.
But I mean, you know, it's not about like, are you going through less or more than someone else?
Right. It's like, it's not the oppression Olympics or the suffering Olympics.
Yeah, it's like, this is a serious medical experience, and like, you deserve to have community and support to go through this. And I feel like if it was a different part of the body, you would. Like, you see breast cancer.
If I was having my gallbladder removed, that's what I keep.
So breast cancer is like an acceptable form of female suffering that everyone understands. And this amazing endometriosis researcher in the book, she had endometriosis all her life and then ended up getting breast cancer. And she said the year she had breast cancer was like one of the best of her life, because finally people listened to her and sympathized and brought cake and cookies and cards. And like, she didn't have this mysterious, shameful illness that she couldn't explain to anyone.
That's so heartbreaking.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's changing. Like, even in the past 5 years, I literally worked with editors who didn't know the word endometriosis. And I think this really is changing fast. And I think it clearly can be done. And something like breast cancer is a model that there can be a huge community and funding around this.
And that model even helped me because I keep likening, you know, this surgery that I'm about to go through to a preventive mastectomy. Like, it's as if I found out I was BRCA positive, I found out that I had a lot of risk factors, and instead of waiting to see if it happens, I'm going to prevent it from happening. And that's really kind of what I'm doing with my uterus. And I feel like that model has been helpful, A, because I see cancer patients who have gone through this, but also because I think that's understood. I think people like Angelina Jolie and, you know, individuals who had a strong voice about this and who kind of stood up and said, this is what I'm dealing with, helped a lot of people understand
it. And you're getting that with other forms of these illnesses, like Amy Schumer or Lena Dunham and stuff. Like,
Oh, for sure. You're right. Yeah. They've written pretty extensively about endometriosis, haven't they?
Yeah. So I think that when you have people with name recognition and power who can help lift some of the shame and stigma and allow people to come out with it, then maybe that starts off this process. But that makes a lot of sense comparing it to the preventative mastectomy.
So I know that we are running low on time and you had a tight window today for us to meet. But right before we go, I ask everybody, Rachel, to answer the same two closing questions. And they're sort of big picture questions, but I'm always curious about my different guests' perspective. So I was hoping that you could give them a quick shot before we close up. Okay, so when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you, so it could have to do with the work that you do, it could be personal, it could be personal, communal, national, global, cosmic, whatever is relevant. Number one, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night, that worries you the most, that you're maybe kind of bordering on cynical or pessimistic about? And on the flip side of that, so we end on a slightly more positive note, where are you finding your hope and your optimism? What are you looking forward to?
Whoa, those are big questions.
Right. And I just threw them at you.
No, I mean, I think about this stuff all the time, so it's not too hard to like scrape the top of my brain, like a DNC of my brain.
Yes, exactly.
Wow, that is gross.
Get it out of there.
No, that just sounds painful.
I have to say too, it's so funny because, like, sorry to interject, but your last name Gross. I had a professor in college named Gunther Gross, and every time I would be like, "That's so gross," he would go, "Don't use my name in vain."
I love and embrace it now, honestly. Like, I think there have been some comments that are like, "What an unfortunate name for this book," and I'm like, "Well, if you don't equate the vagina with gross, then I don't really see what your issue is."
Ever.
And like, oh, yes, Jesus. I do love what many would consider gross science, but I find it everywhere. Anyways, I love my last name. So on the cynical side,
what worries you? Yeah.
Well, here's the personal. So like you're kind of deciding whether to talk about your own medical experience and like, how will this look on me? I really went back and forth a lot over to whether to include myself in the book, because most of the book is not about me. It's about following these scientists and how they're reimagining these organs. But I felt that since it's a book about how the people doing science and investigating shapes the science and how their attitudes and experiences and assumptions play in, the reader deserved to know, like, kind of my window in. And so I actually started the introduction with the story of my vaginal infection and how I accidentally swallowed my vagina poison. Yeah, read the book for that. So I did not intend to have something that personal in there. And again, I was just like, is it okay to write about your recurrent vaginal infections in a science book? And will this make people turned off or think of me as, I don't know, less, not the narrator they wanted. But I felt it was very important and it was extremely relevant to the chapter on the vaginal microbiome and all the kind of forces that resulted in us not looking closely at this like really amazing teeming ecosystem until now. So the researchers that study these infections, which have no good cure, which is why I was given rat poison, my doctor's words, as a suppository to use to put up my vagina to fix this. The reason is twofold. It's one, people think vaginas are gross, and so it causes discomfort. And when these researchers approach startups, venture capital funders, people like walk away from them, and they're just like, oh no, we definitely don't want to talk about bugs in the vagina. And the second part is that they're not taken seriously because they don't kill you. And endometriosis has faced the same problem. Breast cancer kills you. And these kind of issues, like vagina problems, sexual issues, recurrent infections that like really destroy people's lives and actually do affect fertility in many cases, but really have all these other effects on your relationships, your relationship with your body, and like your sexuality, are just not given serious consideration and, importantly, funding. And I heard this so many times with so many different conditions that did start to depress me. Even people would make the comparison, like fecal transplants, you know, people are like, poop is gross, but this is necessary, like drastic times call for drastic measures, and we're dealing with infections that could kill you. So we're definitely going to invest in fecal transplants, and that became huge and successful. And like, we're still working on that for the vaginal microbiome, among other things. So I think that if those attitudes persist in like higher funding bodies, then it'll be really difficult to get these innovative and important treatments off the ground. Now for something positive. Okay.
Sometimes this is the hardest question in the entire interview to answer.
Just in the 4 years since I started writing this book, I've seen such incredible change in mainstream media headlines, conversations, and in, I don't know what to call them, kind of like special interest groups, or like groups essentially of patients who are educating and communicating and making themselves heard. So for instance, there's a podcast called Tight Lipped that is, first of all, amazingly named, but second of all, awesome. It's women, non-binary people, and just people who deal with vulval vaginal pain and pelvic pain. And in looking into this, it really does get into that like bias in the history of medicine and the kind of medical gaslighting that so many patients face about their pain, and how medicine has very few tools or little interest in addressing it. And they have a zine. They're just really educated people that are like kind of studying like how medical education gets done and making a space in a community that does remind me of like the women's like self-help movement, kind of the consciousness raising. Similarly, I've worked quite a lot with intersex activists like the group Interact, and like it's just incredible when I read about the history of and talked to like the founder of the intersex movement in America about how she felt this deep shame and stigma that, you know, like affected her whole life. She felt like she was the only one who had this condition, and she felt monstrous. And since then, there is a huge like pride movement. Intersex is part of the LGBTQIA, go pride, spectrum, and the education around it and the headlines and the wins, against hospitals getting bans on these surgeries have been enormous. Like there's still so much work to be done, but I now see kids growing up with models to follow and a sense of joy and not being subjected to surgeries. And there is a community there and a growing, I think, awareness even within medicine, you know, with many hurdles and some resistance, but there's definitely like a widening of medicine to understand gender differences, sex differences, and that these are, at the bottom of it, human beings with unique anatomy that deserves to be protected. So I'm hoping, like, I can't say for sure, that there is a wider movement in like sex education and medical education to incorporate this growing understanding of the beautiful and wide diversity of bodies and what is considered normal variation and what doesn't need to be medicalized or intervened with.
As am I. Well, everyone, the book is Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage by Rachel E. Gross. Rachel, thank you so much for spending time with us today. This was cathartic for me, of course, but also really informative and just warm. And I'm just really grateful that we had the opportunity to chat. And I'm just so grateful that you wrote this book and that this is available for folks to pick up right now. So go out and get your copy. Come on, people.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. This was such a good conversation. And like, like I said, I'm really like moved and honored by how honest you are. And it's great to talk to you. Thank you for asking me to come on.
You too. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.